You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, that are the sole translators of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of a group of cycles of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Dying Earth and Living Cosmos, The Living Gifts of Anthroposophy, The Need for New Forms of Consciousness. Collected Works, Volume 181. We are on the first cycle, and this is Lecture 2, translated by Matthew Barton, given in Berlin on the 29th of January, 1918. We have often considered the saying, Know thyself, whose light shines through every era. It stood above the temple of Apollo in ancient Greece and embodies a great and infinite prompting to develop human and therefore universal wisdom. It is a saying, however, which was significantly renewed and deepened by the impulse given by the mystery of Golgotha. We will be speaking of all these things this winter, perhaps, if time allows, seeking to find our way to the goals they embody. Today I would like to begin with observations on the human being of a seemingly outward nature, a form of human self-knowledge that appears external, but in fact has a powerful initial impetus if we first take possession of it and then draw on it to penetrate our inner nature. I want to begin, though only seemingly, from a consideration of the outward human form. When mainstream scientists observe this outward human form, they do so in a way that is fairly unsatisfying from a higher spiritual standpoint. Science, as practiced today, offers little stimulus for a recognition of really human qualities. You can see from various comments in my book titled Riddles of the Soul what ordinary science has to say on this subject. The book offers important foundations for developing far-reaching insight into human nature, but currently these foundations appear of no concern to science. And anatomy, physiology, and other such disciplines offer very little to someone who seriously questions and seeks to fathom human nature by starting with an understanding of our outward physical form. An artistic mode of inquiry actually offers far more in this respect. In many ways, modern science takes us no further. Someone who decides to seek more substantial reality through an artistic, a Goethean mode of inquiry, may perhaps find his way to greater truth today than he will by following the paths of mainstream science. As little as this is apparent today, in future a world view arising from spiritual science and originating in a certain human thirst for knowledge will unite a scientific and an artistic sense of the world in a higher harmonious synthesis. This will contain much more clairvoyance than exists in the clairvoyance many today dream of, but only dream of. If we study the human form, we can initially perceive something important in it if we turn our gaze, something more or less all of you have done, to the skeleton, this basic framework of the human form. No doubt you will have all seen a human skeleton and noted the differentiation that exists between the head and the rest of the form. You will have noticed, too, that the head is in a sense a self-contained whole, which rests as if on a column upon what constitutes the system of limbs, the rest of the human organism. It is easy in a skeleton to distinguish the head from the rest of the human form. In the most superficial differentiation of this kind, we discover that the head is really more or less spherical, not a perfect sphere, but an approximate one. Now, as a spiritual scientific researcher, one has to caution people against basing their search for knowledge on superficial outward analogies. But this view of the approximately spherical nature of the human head is not superficial. The human being really is a kind of duality, initially, and the spherical shape of his head is not in the least random. We have to give full attention to what we see before us in the human head, and first hints of this have been offered as part of our inquiries in spiritual science in the book I call titled The Spiritual Guidance of Man and Humanity. There I indicated that the human head is an image of the whole universe, which appears outwardly to us as a hollow sphere of space. In talking of these things, we have to note something that modern people are far removed from applying to the most important areas of inquiry, but which they do always use in a certain domain, at the same time ignoring its huge implications. It will not occur to anyone who uses a compass, a magnetic needle. One of those ends points to magnetic north and the other to magnetic south, to seek the causes of the movements of this magnetic needle only in the needle itself. The physicist will feel obliged, instead, to regard the magnetic needle and the magnetic force issuing from the Earth's magnetic north pole as a connected whole, a force that directs one end of the compass needle toward the north pole and the other toward the south. Here, therefore, we look into the whole universe to find the causes of movements in the smallest domain. But we do not do the same where we should, where it would be very important to do so. Today, when we see that a second living creature is forming inside a first, and where, therefore, something is likewise occurring in the smallest space, say an egg forming in a chicken, we do not usually apply what we learn from the magnetic needle and recognize that what is happening does not lie in the chicken itself, but in the whole cosmos. But in the same way that the greater universe participates in the magnetic needle, so the whole cosmos participates in the developing egg in the chicken's body, alongside all other processes involved in this. The spherical form of the cosmos is involved. The genetic processes of inheritance, leading back to previous generations, only accompany what happens when the egg cell develops in the mother organism. This is heretical to a modern scientific outlook, and yet it is true. The powers of the cosmos participate in diverse ways. And as true as it is to say, and empirical embryology demonstrates it, that the germinal form of the human head develops first in the womb, so it was true, too, that these developments are caused by primal powers working in from the whole universe, and that this human head is an image of the whole cosmos. By contrast, what hangs down from the head, the rest of the skeleton, can show us, if we observe it very carefully, that its form and configuration have more connection with the line of genetic inheritance, with father, mother, grandfather, and grandmother, than with what exists out in the cosmos. Initially, therefore, the human being is a kind of dual being, also in relation to his origins and development. His form emerges from the cosmos on the one hand, and this comes to expression in the spherical form of his head, and from the whole line of genetic descent, on the other, is expressed in the rest of his organism, attached to the head. The human being's whole outward shape reveals him to be a hybrid, if you like, a being of dual nature. Besides the fact that this is instructive, such a mode of observation has a quite different significance, too. We become immobile in our thoughts and at odds with outward life, start living in a buttress of thoughts, if we observe the human being in accordance with ordinary mainstream science. If, say, we look into a microscope and watch the developing embryo, observing only what is contained in it, as if one were to study the magnetic needle very closely to find out what makes it move in a north-south orientation. And then, if we apply such thoughts, in turn, to the social realm, to sociology, they are simply inadequate, or lead to the kind of schoolmasterly abstractions we might also call Wilsonism. It does matter very much what kind of thinking we develop, what thought forms arise in us as we embrace certain ideas. Knowledge itself has less importance compared with this. The important thing is that what gives rise in us to a certain mode of knowledge and the usefulness it cultivates. If we have an open mind for ways in which the human being is connected and related to the whole universe, this will awaken in us thoughts that lead us into an ethical worldview, a view of human rights which today ought to be accorded the highest value, but has become something very strange. You can see, therefore, that curiosity, a mere desire for knowledge, is not the only impulse for seeking the kinds of knowledge I have referred to here. Before us stands the human being, therefore, as a hybrid. This has still deeper significance. Today I only want to strike some fundamental notes to elicit in you an inner sense of the importance of what we will be considering here. Let us stay for a moment with the fact that our head, in the further course of life, this head which we meet as an image of the whole world, is basically the mediator of our perception. I won't say the tool, since this would not be entirely correct. But the head is not alone in mediating our perception. Let's stay with perception and knowledge, with sensory perception. This head does mediate this, but along with the rest of our organism. And since the rest of us, even as regards its origins, is entirely different from the head, so, inasmuch as we are perceiving beings, we consist of the head system and the heart system, as I tended to call it, since there in the heart system everything else congregates and is concentrated. We really are two different beings at once, a head person who stands in a perceiving relationship with the world, and a heart person. The difference is this, that however much we sometimes find fault with the world, we only use our head to perceive and know things. What is this due to? If we were to draw parallels between head perception and heart perception, this would not tell us very much. Someone capable of grasping with his heart what his head perceives would cultivate a warmer kind of knowledge than another. Human beings would be differentiated in this respect, but it would hardly be a major distinction. But if we approach things with spiritual scientific experience, something quite different becomes apparent. After all, we acquire perceptions. Gradually they approach us and develop in us, and then the following occurs. The way we relate to the world through our head, the way we perceive things, happens quickly in some respects, whereas the way we perceive the world through the rest of our organism occurs slowly. In addition to all the differentiation I described last winter in relation to the evolution of the world and the human being, it is also true that our head perception rushes while the rest of our organism does not. This is hugely significant. If we are educated in an abstract, schoolmasterly way, our head is educated primarily. Nowadays, people are raised and educated only in respect of the head. At the very latest, if the head participates for a long time in the development of perception and knowledge, but in most people this does not last so long, its development concludes in a person's 20s. At this point, the head has completed its perceiving appropriation of the world. The rest of our organism, on the other hand, requires the whole of life until we die. And we can say, therefore, that the head lives roughly 3 times faster than the rest of our organism. The rest of the organism takes its time, takes 3 times as long, lives at a quite different tempo. Someone who has the gift of observing and grasping such things realizes that whenever he grasps something through his head, he still has to wait for it to unite with his whole being. For full and living assimilation of something that has been absorbed by the head in around 1 day, we have to wait 3 to 4 days. The conscientious spiritual researcher will never communicate what he has absorbed merely through his head, but only what he has understood with his whole being. This is extraordinarily important, far-reaching in scope and of deep significance. In schools as they exist today, we can really only offer our children a kind of head knowledge, rather than one the rest of the organism can assimilate. The knowledge conveyed there is prepared in such a way that it has to be quickly absorbed by the head, so that one can recall it again later. After their last exam, though, people scarcely remember anything of what they learned in this way, and are pleased if they can't. The kind of knowledge, by contrast, that can be entirely assimilated by the rest of the organism would be one which later, in recalling it, would invoke in us qualities such as love, joy, and warmth of heart. How we structure lessons so that for the rest of his life a person can look back on his education with warmth of heart, joy, and a certain feeling of bliss is connected with the deepest mysteries of humanity. An awful lot needs doing in this field. You see, people versed in educational matters will know that everything we present to children nowadays has been prepared in advance in a way that prevents the rest of our organism from assimilating it, and such knowledge will not engender joyfulness later. This is also why people grow old at a relatively young age nowadays. You see, it is a secret of human development that when the head, say, is 28, the rest of the organism, with its slower mode of development, is only a third or a quarter as old. The rest of our organism runs at a tempo that is 3 or 4 times slower. We will be studying other relationships too. Now, if educators took account of these mysteries, people would be able to absorb and assimilate something so fruitful and health-giving that it would last them until they died. If a person has absorbed such things by the age of 25 and then needs 3 times longer to process and assimilate them, then the rest of his organism would have done so by the time he reached 75. On the other hand, the knowledge we acquire through our head does not have any comprehensive importance for our whole being. Only the deep inward experience and knowledge our whole being acquires can have this importance. But there is a general disinclination for such knowledge today. People commonly seek head wisdom only. Actually, you can do some simple calculations based on what I have said, to find that ideas a person has absorbed through his head by the age of 15 will still need to be assimilated, and that he will not really be mature enough to engage his whole being in a particular kind of work, say public administration, or as a member of parliament, until the age of 45. If it has been possible by the age of 15 to endow someone with conceptual powers that can be gradually assimilated by his whole being, he will be mature enough by the age of 45 to be elected to a city council or a national parliament. In ancient times, people still had living knowledge of this from the mysteries. Today, by contrast, efforts are largely geared to lowering the age for everything, to speeding things up, since nowadays a person is as ready for things at 20 as he would only have been at 80. In the past. Yet these things cannot be determined by wishful thinking, only by true insight. These things can certainly be applied to life and have fundamental significance. Our whole public life is geared to what human beings are by virtue of their heads. In interacting socially with each other, people only interact with their heads. Just imagine this. All social interaction is just head interaction and highly unsuited for shaping social life. For where does the head originate? As we saw, the human head is not of this earth, but originates in and is created from the cosmos. One cannot deal with earthly matters with the head. In our head, we do not belong to a particular nation or region of the globe. We should only use it to decide things common to the whole earth. But even to be able to do that, we have to grow into what belongs to the earth throughout our life, what makes us a citizen of the earth, rather than a citizen of the heavens. Any judgments we make about public matters have to be drawn from deeper insights into the human being. And then, in turn, and today, I am only sketching outlines that we will elaborate further on future occasions. We need to consider the profound meaning of what Goethe expressed as the idea of metamorphosis, which has far wider application than even Goethe himself was able to see in his own day. Our head is formed from the cosmos. If we consider this from the perspective of spiritual science, we see that in the whole period between death and a new birth, working in the cosmos, we are preparing to form our head. We work on our organism between death and rebirth, primarily by working on our future head. In a sense, this head is the grave of the soul, in comparison with the nature of the soul before birth, or let us say before conception. The activities we undertake in a life of spirit between death and a new birth come to rest in the head. And then the stream of inheritance adds and attaches the rest of the organism to what is, in a sense, formed out of the world of spirit. But what is the nature of this inherited addition? It too is connected with the head. I have said this before. The rest of the human organism, apart from the head, is the germ and foundation of the head of our subsequent incarnation. The whole of the rest of the organism is something that can pass through a metamorphosis to become the head of the following incarnation. When we cross the threshold of death, the powers we develop throughout our life pull free from the whole of the rest of the organism, but remain in the configurations which the rest of the organism possessed during life. In the period between death and a new birth, we bear this with us, forming it into our future head. And so our head is always a legacy from the last incarnation. And in the rest of our organism, we have, therefore, something that will determine how our head is formed and configured in a coming incarnation. In this way, too, we have a dual nature. When we gain this perspective on things, we see that the human being is truly embedded in the cosmos, and therefore does not originate solely in the dimensions of space and time we are aware of in our outward physical perception, but is part of the whole huge context of existence. It is a fascinating thing, not only to observe a bone in the spinal column and note, as Goethe did, how it relates to the skull bones, and to see that the latter are only transformed vertebra, but also to discover that everything in the head has its counterpart, too, in the rest of the organism. We have to observe in a very open-minded way, however, to discern not only how the nose and everything in the head is a metamorphosis of this kind, but also to see that the whole of the rest of the organism is at an earlier stage of metamorphosis compared with what we find in the head. There are extremely important educational consequences of such an outlook, as I said. If people begin to grasp these spiritual scientific insights, they will come to embrace some really very significant requirements for the practice of teaching. One thing is important above all. We grow old through our life, but really we ought to say only that our physical body grows old. You see, as strange as it may seem, and I have mentioned this before, our ether body, the next spiritual aspect of our being, grows ever younger. The older we become, the younger becomes our etheric body. We get wrinkles and go bald in physical terms, but in terms of our etheric body, we become, or we can become, ever chubbier cheeked and flourishing. But just as outer nature ensures that the physical body grows older, so we ourselves must ensure that our etheric body receives youthful powers. And this can only be done if we introduce, through the head, the kind of thoughts that are spiritual sustenance for us and are fit to be assimilated throughout our lives. Think for a moment of how one might teach very young children about the human being as an image of the whole universe, an image of the divine world order. But do this in a way that the child can directly and immediately grasp, rather than simply reading out words from the Bible the child does not understand. Drawn from the integrity of a science of the spirit, all this can offer a more full-blooded head knowledge than is common today, and will then become a source of rejuvenation throughout a person's life. Our modern education is no source of rejuvenation, but the opposite. And if today we are fortunate enough not to have become the most withered sour pots, this is only because the current way of addressing the head alone, which has been developing for the past 400 years or so, and has now reached its culmination, has not yet succeeded in wrecking all the inherited culture that survives from olden times. But if we continue as we are doing, we are heading for a form of education that really will produce dried-up sour pots. I said this recently. The war interrupted these developments. That in the years before the war, a growing stream of people were flooding the sanatoria, and much effort and expense was required to try to rid people of their nervous complaints. This is all connected with the fact that the head is not given what the whole person needs. I have spoken about how little of the right attention or care is given to such things. I often recall visiting a sanatorium a few years ago to see someone there. We arrived at lunchtime, and a whole crowd of patients were walking by. Some of them were certainly quite troubled in appearance, with their nervous condition inscribed upon their faces and hands or feet twitching. But the most restless twitcher, the most nervous person in the sanatorium, was the chief consultant there. And it has to be said that a chief consultant will not find the right approach to curing his patients if he is the one most in need of a cure. Otherwise, he was an extremely kind man, but at the same time an example of someone who in his youth had not, at least, been able to absorb what could have rejuvenated him throughout a lifetime. Such things cannot be altered by isolated reforms, but can only be improved if the whole social organism is improved. We have to look at the whole social organism. The great universal laws of existence ensure that human beings cannot find healing, be made whole in egotistical isolation, but only by seeking it in community with others. If we not only picture the sensory reality commonly regarded as the only one, but look beyond this to supersensible realms as the source of powers to reform the world in the near future, we can envisage how in education and diverse other fields, a science of the spirit can be introduced into life, can be authentically developed in tangible ways. There is actually no need to urge visionary clairvoyance to do this. We need only understand the human being as an image of world spirituality. And then a spiritual outlook will inform what we do. It is impossible to comprehend the whole human being without understanding and considering the spirit intrinsic to him. And as I have often said, it is vital to lay aside a very prevalent habit, a lethargy about knowledge and inquiry. All our spiritual scientific observations show us that we must take one step after another, must be willing to engage in details and specifics, to build up a whole picture from these details. We must start from what is close at hand and from there raise it toward the supersensible. What lies close to hand in the sensory realm shows us the supersensible almost tangibly at work. You see, if we can study the human head in the right way, we can see what is formed from the whole cosmos, and can study in the rest of the human organism what will develop back into the cosmos, and in turn reappear from it in a following incarnation. If we truly study sensory reality, we can certainly arrive at a true view of the supersensible. But to do so, we must be willing to leave our comfort zone sufficiently to allow the true nature of the human being to emerge, at least to the extent of according him the respect one happily accords a clock or another very ordinary object. Anyone with the least mechanical knowledge will admit that he cannot understand a clock unless he considers the interrelationship of its clockwork. And yet all and sundry hold forth on human nature without the same premise, believing they can speak about the loftiest human qualities, often citing the idea that, quote, truth must be simple, close quote. Spiritual science is accused of being far too complex. People might think it desirable to acquire in 5 minutes or less what is needed for insight into the loftiest human nature. But the human being is actually very complex, and his grandeur in the universe consists of his complexity. The inclination to lethargy must be overcome in our pursuit of knowledge if we really wish to penetrate human nature. There is no contemporary understanding of what is needed unless people are willing to try, at least intuitively, to grasp the whole complexity of human nature. If we cultivate nothing but head knowledge, and do not wish to assimilate with our whole being what the head learns, nor, even in the first place, give the head something that the whole human being can assimilate, we place the human being into a social order in a way that refuses to make earthly life into an image, a reflection of supersensible spiritual life. Then we suffer from a strange split in our nature. Not a duality of the kind I mentioned, but a harmful split we need to overcome. During the course of evolution, human life has undergone changes. To observe this, we need to go back 400 years, or not even that long. Those familiar with the realities of cultural history, rather than history as it is usually recorded, know how hugely different was the life and thinking of the 18th century compared to that of the 19th. Human thinking as a whole, as it developed gradually toward the 20th century, formulated increasingly abstract concepts, head concepts. If we study the full-blooded nature of human concepts in the 13th and 14th centuries, and consider the natural science of those times, we find a very striking difference compared to the abstract, arid principles governing modern science. Some very interesting things are contained in a well-known book said to have been written by Basilius Valentinus. Recently, a Swedish scholar wrote a book about matter, citing various comments by Valentinus, and coming to the conclusion that no one in their right mind can understand such things. It is self-evident that he cannot understand Valentinus's book, since it will be entirely incomprehensible if you bring to bear on it concepts drawn from modern physics and chemistry. This is connected with realities related to those which led to the good old German proverb, quote, "The early morning has God and gold in its mouth," close quote, changing over time to merely, quote, "The early morning has gold in its mouth," close quote. A good old European proverb has thus been Americanized. Footnote, translator's note, Benjamin Franklin is said to have coined the expression, quote, early to bed and early to rise makes a man healthy, wealthy, and wise, close quote. End of footnote. In those olden times, descriptions and views of nature were imbued with what originates in the whole human being. Nowadays, we have head knowledge. On the one hand, this is very abstract and arid and does not imbue a person throughout his life, and on the other hand, it is very spiritual. Our dual nature is such that we engender the most spiritual qualities today, for our abstract concepts are the most spiritual thing imaginable. And yet, they are incapable of comprehending the spirit. It is extremely easy to see what split is caused in us by these spiritual concepts we have developed. Strangely, we have become materialists as a result of these spiritual concepts. But if concepts were true, they could never give rise to materialism. The very presence of our abstract concepts is already a first refutation of materialism. We live in this split. Over the past 400 years, we have spiritualized ourselves to a huge degree. And in this spiritual quality, which we only possess in the abstract, we need to find the living spirit again. We have developed to the point of having only objectivized concepts. But now we must return to imagination, inspiration, and intuition again. We laid aside what was handed down to us from earlier primordial, inherited wisdom as imaginations, inspirations, and intuitions. But now, having shed a full-bodied, full-blooded form of knowledge, we must develop these faculties again. This is something that can fill us with a sense of seriousness toward spiritual science. These two first lectures have been more introductory in nature, and it has been my aim to show that the most external view of human nature can fuel our impulse to study the spiritual foundations of the world. As humanity pursues these impulses and ideas, it will discover something so sorely lacking at present, an inner truthfulness. One cannot seek the Spirit in a fruitful way without inner authenticity and truthfulness. And we will never go wrong if we let our life experience and insights teach us that a proper harmony between head knowledge and heart knowledge is only possible if we place ourselves into life in an authentic way. You see, this is precisely why people today do not wish to lead their head knowledge into heart knowledge, because heart knowledge not only requires longer, but also reacts, pushes back against head knowledge if it is untrue. The rest of our being then becomes apparent as a kind of conscience, and contemporary humanity, with its predilection for the head, is afraid of this. And now, to end with, since whenever we are gathered here, we always also need to gauge the position of our spiritual scientific striving in relation to the whole world, a few remarks on directly practical matters. Spiritual science can only thrive if we stand behind it seriously and truthfully, since it needs to respond to humanity's deepest needs in the modern world. It must allow the pangs of conscience that tend to arise whenever the heart says no to the head, which it always does when we do not seek the Spirit or only strive for knowledge egotistically out of desire, ambition, and so forth. For this reason, it is important to avoid the least compromise in our pursuit of spiritual science. The science of the Spirit has to be pursued positively, out of its own intrinsic quality, and compromises involving partial truths or fractions of truths are untenable. It is too serious a matter to dabble with in this way. The remarks below, following on from our introductory thoughts, are not intended personally, though they do have a personal dimension. We can only understand a great deal of the opposition to spiritual science if we consider where it originates and how it develops. Here and there we witness someone who attacks spiritual science in the fiercest way. There are instances of a different kind to those I am thinking of now, but in many cases, opposition to spiritual science emerges from circumstances such as those illustrated by the following specific example. On one occasion, I was due to give a lecture in Frankfurt when I received a phone call from a gentleman who wished to speak with me. I had nothing against it and made an appointment with him. He arrived and said, quote, "I've been traveling around after you for ages and am very keen to talk to you," close quote. I had nothing against this, though nothing much for it either. The man carried on talking about all kinds of things. But the science of the spirit has to be taken seriously, and this means rejecting the empty appearance of scholarly interest. You can't keep making compromises. I remained polite to the man. I let him say what he wanted, but at the same time allowed him to see that I would not be taking any further notice of him. I was convinced he was talking hot air, although seeking connection and confirmation. I'm quoting this example just as an illustration of the kind of thing that happens. I let the man go on talking until he ran out of steam. Much that he said was very flattering indeed, but the only thing that mattered was whether his, in quotes, spiritual scientific endeavors had any truth. Not long afterward, news reached me from Switzerland that the same man was condemning the demonic and devilish nature of Steiner's spiritual science. There's an afterword to this story, but I will leave that aside for now. Here, you see, is one of the ways in which opposition arises, very frequently from people who wanted to become part of our endeavors, and yet who, for certain reasons, had to be ignored. There's a lot that has to be ignored in keeping spiritual science intact. In this connection, I would like to mention something else. Our dear friend Dr. Rittelmeyer recently wrote an article in the journal Die Christliche Welt about the relationship between religious questions and our science of the spirit, at the same time seeking to dispel various prejudices about the latter in an extremely laudable way. We should be thankful to him for this. I hope you will all read the article. Subsequently, Dr. Johannes Müller, whom many of you know, saw fit to attack Dr. Rittelmeyer's article in 3 successive issues of the same journal. I have no wish to engage in any way with what Dr. Müller wrote there. Actually, I spent years without number trying not to speak about Dr. Johannes Müller, since my aim is to keep spiritual science free of dilettantism and not muddy its waters with compromise. I think one best achieves this if one does not directly speak of things whose own intrinsic value, if they have any, will become apparent by themselves. I have never before mentioned Dr. Johannes Müller. Now, in our era, people have little sense for what is actually true or untrue in this domain. If you study Johannes Müller's articles, you will find that they contain a great deal of what one has to call objective untruths, whether due to unthinking superficiality or other causes. They are full of such things. In my book titled Riddles of the Soul, I described an instance of this untruth in books by Dessoir. I'm looking forward to seeing what response I get to my critique of the work of this man, a professor at Berlin University. Presumably there must be one. The second essay entitled Riddles of the Soul describes Professor Dessoir's manner of writing, and if reviewers of Dessoir fail to consider what I have said there, they will share responsibility for his failings. Yet people often just resort to the excuse nowadays that they didn't know and were obliged to read what others had written. Well, I will let those who are familiar with Johannes Müller's lectures and utterances form their own views about little squibs sent in my direction, about my supposed, quote, crass self-advertisement, close quote, and so on, and about my lectures appealing to people's sensationalism. Not very long ago, an elderly gentleman, whom I greatly esteem, because he is very conscientious in the way he expresses himself, told me he was surprised so many people attended my lectures, since I took no pains to simplify things. It is very easy to demonstrate that Johannes Müller's accusations are untrue. In cities where spiritual science has not yet taken root, not very many people attend my lectures usually. And where many attend, this is because the lecture is given in a locality where a lot of preparatory work has been done. I don't wish to spend any more time on Johannes Müller, but I will just comment on this last paragraph, which claims that I speak of the, in quotes, drama of God, who is to be redeemed by humankind, and such like. He gets a column and a half of text out of quoting my book titled Christianity is Mystical Fact, but does so out of context, in any order he sees fit. And by doing so, by conveniently leaving things out, what he says becomes utter nonsense. In fact, in my book on Christianity, the very opposite is said about the drama of God and his enchantment. Johannes Müller talks his way out of this by saying he has been unable to grasp what I wrote. I well believe him. Without having understood anything at all, Johannes Müller sets to work to tear the book apart. As I have often said, the book places absolute and primary importance on the mystery of Golgotha, as distinct from all other mysteries. But Müller has no sense at all of this. I would never ask him to understand the book, since I don't believe he is able to do so. But nevertheless, he criticizes it. And the remarkable thing is this, that it was published in 1902, and by 1906 had, therefore, been available for 4 years. In the first edition, as was known, I had explained my relationship to science on the one hand, and to philosophy on the other, and the book was in the public domain. But if Johannes Müller remained unaware of it, that is a matter for him. The book was in the public domain in 1906, and related to my whole worldview in the same way as, for example, the philosophy of freedom. And therefore anyone who formed an opinion about me in 1906 would have been obliged to consider this worldview and not start from half or partial truths. In 1906, Christianity as Mystical Fact had been around for 4 years. Yet in 1906, Johannes Müller sent me the book he had written entitled The Sermon on the Mount, with the dedication, quote, to Dr. R. Steiner, with appreciation of the philosophy of freedom, Meinberg, 17806. This mention was one I felt it necessary to ignore, since in the ways I have described it was impossible to compromise. And I consider myself entitled to fall silent rather than to try to explain my views of someone's propositions. But silence can annoy people more than anything. As I said, one has to seek opposition to spiritual science in actual circumstances and relationships. And whoever reads Dr. Johannes Müller's essays about our friend Dr. Rittelmeier may do well not just to make this opposition at face value, but discern the background to it. We have to look closely to see truer reasons that lie beneath the surface. To fail to respond to an, quote, appreciation of the philosophy of freedom, close quote, can antagonize the person who is hoping to be flattered in return. I wanted to give you this little glimpse into the psychology of Johannes Müller, so that you have a little more background and therefore see his articles in a clearer light. The end of Lecture 2.